Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and this week on From the Vault, we take a moment to reflect on the passing of an American icon, the voice of a century, Studs Terkel. In homage to Mr. Terkel, we present Studs Terkel, A Spoken Century, produced and written by Haunani Singer. We love you, Studs.
Flash! A whole new century, the 20th. America says goodbye forever to its naive and rural past. For this new century, nothing less than a whole new national identity. Industrialization. Henceforth, all farmers are hicks. Real men breed machines. Pastures, they're strictly from corn. The new crop is skyscrapers. No more trimming the wick, Martha. Flip a switch and light up St. Louis. Forget the buggy, buy the automobile, or visit the old country on an unsinkable liner larger than the town you were born in. It's a brave new world indeed. And what dread hand and what dread eye could frame this fearful cacophony? Where, in all this noise, was the voice of man?
1912. That year the Titanic went down, and as saying was, I came up.
Years old, and my father was ill, a good man, a tailor, and we got some dough from a rich relative whom we paid back, of course. By a rooming house, my mother ran, and then he got sick again, and later on, my little hotel, the Wells Grand. The Wells Grand, that was a key university for me, more than the University of Chicago Law School, the lobby at the hotel. 1926, I was 13 years old, and then the crash came, 29. You saw that what happened at the hotel, it was empty during the early years they were working. They were skilled craftsmen, some semi-skilled, retired tool and die makers, guys of that sort, retired railroad firemen, electricians, plumbers. And then came the Depression, and then they were in the lobby, and they got drunk, and they were sore at themselves. They weren't going to work and couldn't work, and then you saw what happened. People on relief. And so that played a big role, of course.
Nobody knows you when you're down and out.
You find this in the book Hard Times, because other observers of depression spoke of that. People blame themselves. And Virginia Durr, a very great woman of the South, one of the premature integrationists, she called. She and her husband Clifford Durr were two great Southerners. He was the lawyer for Rosa Parks when she was arrested. Well, Virginia said, preachers blame themselves. You shouldn't have bought that secondhand car or that radio. And people often blame themselves. And that's why they never told many kids, they never told their kids about the Depression. They were ashamed. They thought, well, for a long time they believed that the man behind the mahogany desk is better than I am, because if I were good, I'd be behind the mahogany desk. The American dream. So that played a tremendous role.
On the 14th day of April of 1935, there struck the worst of dust storms that ever filled the sky.
But in the meantime, during all that time, we had arguments at the hotel, the lobby, Saturdays and Sundays, of course. Worked half a day on Saturdays. They'd pay rent. And then things happened. The guys were arguing at the some were union guys, some were Finks, and also on religion, everything in the world. Sorry. A lot of young people today, we know a lot of young people are anti-union, and so a lot of young people we know don't know how Social Security came about, or unemployment. It was unions, bottom-up stuff. One couple I cannot crack. They're waiting for the bus for about a year. A very handsome couple. He's has J. Press suits and Brooks Brothers, and has the latest issue of Wall Street Journal in his hand, and she's very beautiful, stunning, and Neiman Marcus, Bloomingdale, and she's got the latest Vanity Fair in her hand. And so, but I can't crack him. And my ego is, I have an ego, my ego is at stake. And so the bus is late in coming, and I say, Labor Day is coming up. It's the wrong thing to say. The guy looks at me as though now no old coward looking at a speck on a piece of cloth. And now, of course, my ego is really affronted. Banners flying, we shall not be moved, UAW, CIO. About a CIA, I was going to say. And there was that too, you know. kind. But in any event, he says, he turns to me and says, "We despise unions." I said, "Wow, I got a pigeon here." You know, there's no bus. And so I say, it's a non sequitur. I say, "How many hours a day do you work?" And he's caught unaware. He says, "8. I said, "How come you don't work 18 hours a night? You're great. You know why you work 8 hours a night? Because four guys in Chicago in 1886 got hanged fighting for the 8-hour day. I refer to Haymarket Affair. You can see everything's fair in love and war. You know." And by this time, he's a little scared. He's an old nut. You know? And the bus is late and coming. And I got him pinned against the mailbox. He can't get away. You know? Meantime, she's very beautiful. Remember, she's tremulous. She dropped the Vanity Fair, and I pick it up in a courtly fashion, hand it to her, you know. And then I say, "How many hours a week do you work?" Got a pen. He's scared now, I think. And he says, 40. "How come you don't work 80 hours a week?" You know why? Because men and women got their heads busted back in the 30s, fighting for the 40-hour week for you. By this time, they hop on the bus. I never see them again. But to this day, they live in this condominium upscale facing the bus stop. I bet every morning she's looking out that window and he's saying, "Is that old nut still down there?" Now, it's easy to blame them, but how do they know about this? Pick any paper, L.A. Times, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, of course. You got a feature section, sports section, entertainment section, business section. Do you have a labor section? Are you kidding? Labor page, once in a while labor column, that's all. So how do they know? So there's a history denied. And then, of course, what I call a national Alzheimer's disease we have today. There's no memory of yesterday. Well, the lobby of the hotel, and then remember, I'm a Depression boy, and so we didn't lose the hotel. We sold it for practically nothing, but didn't suffer much during the Depression, except that I was a Depression child, and so my dream was 9-to-5 civil service job, you know, which I had for a short time in Washington. And the dream was to be a spectator. So the name of the book is A Spectator. The dream was to see plays and movies and baseball games. The reason I'm called a spectator there is because I saw plays when I was 13, 14 years old as a playgoer, because the hotel, and I speak of that in the introduction, the hotel was right near the theatrical section of the Loop. And the press agents in those days were nice, easygoing guys, and they put a poster up on the lobby. Now, the guys in our lobby didn't see plays. They saw burlesque shows, but not plays. Yeah. Well, I became an actor. I was before the WPA was another project, that Harry Hopkins. Harry Hopkins was Roosevelt's favorite man, and he was his candidate for president if he weren't ill. And so he was head of WPA, but also head of something called FERA before that. And I was on the statistical project, and I met a guy, there was a director. And remember, I'm a dilettante. I've gone to see plays, but never dreamed I'd be in a play. And it's Waiting for Lefty by Clifford Odets at the time. It was during strikes and the taxi cab drive. So the actor isn't there, so I come with this director friend of mine. He's couldn't read it. I read it. He says, "You're going to do the part." So I became an actor. And then soap operas came into being in Chicago. Soap operas were big. Radio soap operas. And the soap operas were all the same. Mary Marlin, who suffered more than St. Teresa ever did. Mondays for Fridays, courtesy of Oxydol. And there was Helen Trent, "Can Woman Find Love After 35? That was the subtitle. Can you not tell long ago? Guiding Light was about a minister that got a job as a gangster. I played the same gangster in every soap opera. There were three gangsters, the bright one, the dumb one, the middle one. I was the dumb one.
The dialogue in all these adventures was like none other ever invented. It was truly sui generis. It wasn't Melville. It wasn't Faulkner. Nor could Chekhov ever have dreamed it up. It was, in short, astounding. Most often, it was offered sotto voce. My confederate and I nuzzled up to the microphone in the manner of Bing Crosby and Russ Columbo. What we crooned boded no good for the good folk. "Boss, you know what to do?" "Me." "Yeah, boss." "Boss, synchronize our watches." "Me." "Watches?" "Yes, stupid, watches." "I got you, boss." "What have you got?" 11. You got New York time, stupid. It's 10 o'clock. We were in Middle America, of course. I got you, boss. Let's go. Okay, boss.
In any event, from that comes someone like me and gave me some dough to sponsor a radio as a disc jockey. The word disc jockey wasn't used in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the records were shellac, and there was a waxen base. You drop it, and they crack. I still have a lot of 78s at home. And who was the figure who really created the record industry? There was one artist, Enrico Caruso. See, every immigrant family, not just Italian, of course, or Jewish families, but every immigrant family of Eastern Europe, all would buy a Caruso record. It was $2 a piece, would be equivalent to about $50 today. And they'd listen. And his voice, John Chardy, the poet, says something about his voice really accentuated the possibilities that are in all people in society. We can go one step higher. And that's what he would do. Caruso, say, in the aria from O Paradiso, the opera, Vasco da Gama and his discoveries. And he's reached the top, and suddenly he goes further.
Then I did radio show disc jockeys. I was disc jockey for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it had a big cult following. I would do the story of the opera as a racetrack tout. Longchamp Sylvester would do. But it was the truth. The actual libretto. Carmen, he says, about a tomato who loved not too wisely but too often. And so you tell the story of Carmen. At the end, when it's all true, when Micaela, his girl, comes and says, your mother's dying, come see her. Carmen, who now sloughs him off, Don Jose, for the Toreador. And he says, Carmen, I did everything for you, you know. And then she says, go home, your mother wants you. And he says, say that again, I'll put a knife on your back. Go home, your mother wants you. So he kills her. And the moral is better a live cold potato than a dead hot tomatoes. And then I would play. Say a 1918 recording of the Habanera by Emma Calvey, a great Carmen, you see. I would do that, or do the story of Isolde. Tristan says to Isolde, 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 I smolder and smolder, you know. And so, but then... then I would do Louis Armstrong's West End Blues, and then Woody Guthrie's Dust Bowl Ballads. And so it would be a combination, and it had a rather interesting cult following.
So... that's when I heard Mahalia Jackson recordings in a record shop one day.
One of these evenings, oh Lord, late one evening, my Lord, late one evening, oh, I'm going home, live on high.
And the song was Move On Up a Little Higher. I never heard a voice like that.
Move on up a little higher, Lord. Meet with old man Daniel. Move on up a little higher, Lord. Meet with the Hebrew children.
So I decided to play her recordings, and I was... she called me the white guy who made her known to the white world. Well, she'd have been known anyway. And see, we worked together a great deal. And this is one of those occasions, I think, when an audience had gathered at the Palmer House. Bernie and Rita Jacobs had the idea of live programmers. And we were there for the audience, and here's some of the stuff.
Well, that,
That song, I'm On My Way, in a way symbolizes Mahalia's life, too. Always the note of hope and affirmation or something. Mahalia, you've had trials and tribulations in your life, too, haven't you?
Yes.
Quite a bit, huh?
Yeah, you too, have you?
Oh, how right.
You wouldn't be the great stud if you had that. Some trials.
But somehow, I know there's one spirit that has the words, but we will overcome. You know, is the idea. You don't have to sing that, but the idea, I know there's some words. We will overcome. Mahalia, back before you go on next song, a question people often ask, and you're the best one to tell. What's the difference? Some people confuse songs between a spiritual and a gospel song. You might tell people the difference.
I think the spiritual became known by Negro spirituals.
But don't spirituals go back to slave days? Gospel songs are more or less created since the war.
The gospel songs are the redeemed songs.
The redeemed songs.
Yeah.
You're not going to try to redeem me tonight.
If I could ever get you saved, it'd be all right.
If anybody can save me, it's Mahalia who can.
Studs and I is always talking about religion. He says, now, you know, when he gets real gone, he said, listen, baby, you almost got me going, baby. Well, Studs is such a fine man, you know, and I suppose some of you wouldn't have known about Mahalia Jackson if it had not been for Stud Terkel. He had a habit when I would meet him sometime to sing different places, and we'd be walking along the streets. He says, this is Mahalia Jackson. And the people say, so? And he would get mad. Well, what do you mean? You don't know Mahalia Jackson? That's the greatest gospel song. And I'd stand up and be dying laughing because he wants everybody to know me. So I think he's done a very fine job in getting you to know me. And he is such a fine friend of mine until... when I come around Studs, I know I got to sing. I wonder how many of you know this particular song. I think everybody in America knows this song. Down by the riverside.
Gonna lay down my soul and cheer. Down by the riverside.
Whoa.
Well, TV was new. It was 1950. It was not the sales medium it is. Chicago was the home of three very interesting programs. There wasn't much on the West Coast at all. TV was 6 to 10 at night. And there were three shows out of Chicago that John Crosby, who was the preeminent TV critic of the New York Herald Tribune, said, this is what TV could be about. All three shows had something in common. They were improvised, happening at a certain moment. People thought it was... one was Garraway at Large. Do you ever hear Dave Garraway? So Dave did an easy show in Chicago called Garraway at Large. And it was very easy. The second show was Cuckoo Fran Ollie.
The cuckoo, she's a pretty bird. She sings as she flies.
With the genius of Chicago TV, Bert Chilstrom. It was wonderful. The third show was Studs Place, the thing I was involved with, my three colleagues. And all three had this quality of something happening at that moment. People thought it was real. And so, well, all of us were hot. Dave was called in, Mike Wallace was called in. I was called in New York, too, but then things happened. I wanted to leave Chicago anyway. And then what happened was McCarthy, the Cold War. And a guy comes from New York and says, you're a hot property. I like that. He says, you're a hot property. He says, but you signed all these petitions. I says, yeah, which ones? Anti-Jim Crow. Yeah, I signed that. Anti-poll tax. Yeah, I signed that. Friendship with the Soviet Union. I mean, this is 1950. Well, 5 years ago, they lost 20 million people on our side, you know. Yeah. Well, you know something? You know what's behind those petitions? Communists. And so now I got Lageria. I can't stop talking, you know. And so I'm a wise guy, too. So I say, suppose communists come out against cancer. Do we have to come out for cancer? And so the guy says, that's not very funny. I said, no, I guess not. And then he says, by the way, Archibald MacLeish wrote a great article about that later on in Atlantic or Harper's, on that very point about being in thraldom to them as they were to us. And so then he says, you got to stand up and be counted. So again, I'm a comic. So I stood up like this. Okay, count me. That's not funny either. Finally, he said, and this is the part that's so funny. He says, why don't you say you were stupid, you were duped, you didn't mean it? I said, but I am anti-Jim Crow. I am that. And to this day, people think, Studs, you were a hero. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. I was scared. The fact is, my ego. Remember talking about my ego earlier with that couple? My ego was affronted. My vanity. And the one thing we lack, the world lacks, so little self-esteem. So we need ego in the very healthy sense. So it was my ego that did it. So when I read Red Channels, I looked at Red Channels. You know what that is, the names of people who were called subversive and all. I see these people I admire, Zero Mostel, Arthur Miller, Lillian Hellman. I look for me. I'm not in it. Which I attribute to New York parochialism. I felt like a blue-haired dowager who didn't make the social register. And so, but then there's a payoff to that part. So I'm not working for a while. And that's why I got lined up with this public, with this radio station. If it were not for the blacklist, I wouldn't have written these books. Now, I'm not suggesting it, you know. But if it weren't for that, these things. So now I hear a radio station, a new station, Chicago, playing good music and literature. A young couple run it. And I hear Woody Guthrie record. I said, no one played Woody except me. So I call up and says, hey, I want to be on your station. Because he says, we'd love to have you on. They knew me, you know, but we're flat broke. I said, so am I. So we started even.